I thought Carolyn's idea of starting out with a quote was a good idea, and I found a couple in a book called Escape from Evil by Ernest Becker, which I think is a good book, but I like these quotes at the front too, because they sort of get at, I think, what might be a felt problem for some of the subject matter that I'm dealing with. I'll read, this quote is from William James. There is no doubt that healthy-mindedness is inadequate as a philosophical doctrine, because the evil facts which it positively refuses to account for are a genuine portion of reality, and they may, after all, be the best key to life's significance, and possibly the only openers of our eyes to the deepest levels of truth. And likewise, along the same lines, this is a quote from Thomas Hardy. If a way to the better, this is from a poem, if a way to the better there be, it lies in taking a full look at the worst.
A full look.
A full look at the worst. And I think that sort of keys what some of the approach that I'm using, in that the material that I tend to deal with is that which in many cases makes people disgusted and they don't want to deal with. And the subject of sexual activity and sexual behavior of humans is something that one scholar has pointed out for the last few centuries was mostly the province of philosophers and theologians and pornographers. And a discussion in between those two levels has been missing. Well, the question, of course, comes about is, what can we learn? Can we learn about human nature, ourselves, or our society? Can we learn anything from some subject like pornography? Now, what I want to do today is to explore that question and discuss the connections between the dangerousness of eroticism, or the dangerousness of human sexuality, as a way of looking at the spiritual realm also, and see if we can find some connections between those two. Because the hypothesis that I'm going to be dealing with is that both our erotic life, or the erotic consciousness, or the pornographic imagination, as someone has pointed out, or used that term, is a departure from everyday reality. In much the same way that spiritual reality is a departure from everyday reality. And we feel that spiritual reality is in some sense an ascent out of everyday reality, and that erotic reality may be felt as some sense of a descent from everyday reality. There's, of course, a lot of approaches to studying sexual behavior and some of its manifestations, like pornography. Most of the studies of sexual behavior on a scientific basis have been just in the last few decades. But as I mentioned, for the last few centuries, some of the only ones to write about sexual behavior were theologians, like Augustine, Aquinas, Luther, Immanuel Kant, who wasn't a theologian but a philosopher. So, because sex is a private affair, it's difficult to study. And there also is a real severe shortage of language with which to talk about sex. Even the word sex, like the way I use the word sex, but that obviously means gender. You know, that's where that comes from, male, female. But we use it as a euphemism to talk about sexual behavior. In the Song of Solomon, there's some beautiful references to sexuality, but if you're acquainted with the Song of Solomon, you also recognize the metaphors that are used there for sexuality. And they're very beautiful ones, and literary ones. We use euphemisms like sleep with, go to bed with, you know, things like that. So it's difficult, and then also I find in the classes that I teach in this area that so many of the ordinary words that we use in everyday language have sexual connotations. And so people will make a statement that they think is pretty free from any sexual meaning, and it'll generate a lot of guffaws, you know, and laughs, and then they'll just realize that there's so many connotations in our everyday language about sex. So what a lot of this points out is that sex has some kind of a special nature to it. That it's something that's both appealing and appalling to us. And I wanted to talk today about how it tends to be outside of everyday reality. Now, one of the more interesting, and it's getting a little old, I think this is 1967 when this was published, an article by Susan Sontag, who's an essayist and fairly well known, called Pornographic Imagination. And in this article, what she tries to show is that pornography has been a genre of literature that has been decried, and most literature professors would say is maybe not legitimate literature, but it's been around for quite a while. And in our tradition, in American literature, we don't really have a history of this as a section of our literature. In Western civilization, the culture that does recognize sexuality as something to study, to enlighten us about human nature in general, or the human psyche, are the French. And the French, probably beginning with the Marquis de Sade. How many people have heard or know who the Marquis de Sade was? Okay, I thought that was common knowledge, and one time I asked one of my classes, and nobody could really say. I thought, oh. The Marquis de Sade was a nobleman who lived around during the time of the French Revolution. And he started out as siding with the Republicans in that revolution. And later, when the Reign of Terror came along, when the French were killing off all the nobility to sort of start over again, he was affected by this drastically, and came to see evil as maybe the only way out. He was incarcerated, or the embrace of evil as the only way out of understanding what was going on. In other words, if one goes into a revolution with the idea that, well, the good and the true is going to come out of this revolution, and then one is faced with the incredible amount of slaughter that's going on. But where is good and bad, or good and evil in this sort of thing? And the Marquis de Sade was imprisoned in the Bastille for a while, and during that time he started writing what we would consider to be some of the most drastic examples of pornography that have ever been written. And his name, Sade, is the root word of the word sadism. Sadism. And masochism and sadism are very strong elements in his writing. But his writings were salvaged from the Bastille when it was destroyed. And they later came to be foundations for the writing of this kind of disgusting, what we would call disgusting or drastic forms of pornography, the kind that are meant to affront, that are meant to shake people out of their whatever their state of mind is at the time. And from that time, in French literature, there's been a tradition of using erotica as a way of maybe casting light on the sense of human nature. And this goes against what we might call our liberal or more modern psychoanalytic view of sexuality, which is that we have this long history of repression in the West, and out of this repression comes sort of a curious interest in what other people do. And because of the absence of sexuality from everyday life, we become, and the absence in talk and conversation and teaching, we become overly interested in other people's sexuality, and out of that comes pornography. The French have a deeper understanding, though, that there's something way back down there in the human psyche that it may be a demonic force of some sort, and that maybe by studying this through literature, we can cast light on the nature of human nature itself. I want to use some of that research and some more modern writings on or about pornography to try to cast light on this nature of human understanding, humans' understandings of themselves. I wanted to quote from this article by Susan Sontag. There may be something here. If you want to react to anything I say as we go along, be sure to say something. What she does in this article is to review some recent works in French pornography, French literary pornography. And probably the most important work in this kind of literature of pornography that's emerged in the last 50 years or so is a book by a person, the pseudonym is Pauline Reage, and the book is called The Story of O. I don't know if you've heard of it before. It was made into a movie, but I don't think the movie really, I think the movie was more just for titillating, you know, people's interest rather than really getting to the source or the purpose of that book. Let me read you, The Story of O is about a girl, a young woman, whose name is never given in the book, it's just O. And O is a symbol, is an ancient symbol for woman. But probably in the context of this book, O refers to zero or nothing, the disappearance of self is one way of putting it. And it's the story of a woman who willingly allows herself to be humiliated over and over again in the most horrible ways as a way of destroying her sense of self. And this paradox of transcending oneself. It's been said that the truly humble person can never be humiliated. And what Pauline Reage, the pseudonym or whoever wrote this book, is interested in getting at is this. The same is this thing that we understand in a religious sense, too, that we transcend ourselves by losing ourselves. We give up ourselves to find ourselves. And so I would like to read a couple quotes from here, and if you have any reaction to them, go ahead and say something. What the story of O unfolds is a spiritual paradox. That the full void and of the vacuity, that of the full void and of the vacuity that is also a plenum. The power of the book lies exactly in the anguish stirred up by the continuing presence of this paradox. Pauline Reage raises in a far more organic and sophisticated manner than Saad does with his clumsy expositions and discourses the question of the status of human personality itself. But whereas Saad is interested in the obliteration of personality from the viewpoint of power and liberty, the author of The Story of O is interested in the obliteration of personality from the viewpoint of happiness. For the paradox to gain real significance, however, the reader must entertain a view of sex different from that held by the most enlightened members of the community. And that's the one that I just gave, the point of view of sex as being pretty much just an everyday thing like conversing with others. That Western civilization has distorted and made into something that is much more dangerous or something much more important than it really is. And that's the view that she doesn't agree with. What difficulties, I'm boring you too much here, but maybe I should read this part. What difficulties arise come from the long this is the accepted sort of academic view of sexuality. What difficulties arise come from the long deformation of the sexual impulses administered by Western Christianity, whose ugly wounds virtually everyone in this culture bears. First guilt and anxiety, then the reduction of sexual capacities, leading if not to virtual impotence or frigidity, at least to the depletion of erotic energy and the repression of many natural elements of the sexual appetite, the perversions. Then the spillover into public dishonesties in which people tend to respond to the news of the sexual pleasures of others with envy, fascination, revulsion, and spiteful indignation. It's from this pollution of the sexual health of the culture that a phenomenon like pornography is derived. But she goes on to say what these French authors show us is that their work suggests that the obscene is a primal notion of human consciousness, something much more profound than the backwash of a sick society's aversion to the body. Human sexuality is quite apart from Christian repressions, a highly questionable phenomenon, and belongs, at least potentially, among the extreme rather than the ordinary experiences of humanity. Tamed as it may be, sexuality remains one of the demonic forces in human consciousness, pushing us at intervals close to taboo and dangerous desires, which range from the impulse to commit sudden arbitrary violence upon another person to the voluptuous yearning for the extinction of one's consciousness, for death itself. Now, this is the part that I wanted to lead up to. One could possibly or plausibly argue that it is quite that it excuse me. One could plausibly argue that it is for quite sound reasons that the whole capacity for sexual ecstasy is inaccessible to most people, given that sexuality is something like nuclear energy, which may prove amenable to domestication through scruple, but then again it may not. That few people regularly or perhaps ever experience their sexual capacities at this unsettling pitch doesn't mean that the extreme is not authentic, or that the possibility of it doesn't haunt them anyway. And then she uses religion as an analogy.
Just as quoting now Susan Sontag rather than from the book.
Right.
Story of Owen.
Religion is probably, after sex, the second oldest resource which human beings have available to them for blowing their minds. You might consider it to be the primary resource. Yet among the multitude of the pious, the number who have ventured very far into that state of consciousness must be fairly small too. There is demonstrably something incorrectly designed and potentially disorienting in the human sexual capacity, at least in the capacities of man and civilization. The woman who is given no other name than O progresses simultaneously toward her own extinction as a human being and her fulfillment as a sexual being. It's hard to imagine how anyone would ascertain whether there exists truly, empirically, anything in nature or human consciousness that supports such a split, but it seems understandable that the possibility has always haunted mankind, as accustomed as he is to decrying such a split. And this is what I'd like to venture to talk about today, is this split in our consciousness between everyday life as we experience it, and on the one hand, erotic reality, and on the other hand, spiritual reality. Alfred Schutz was an Austrian sociologist philosopher who was a student of Edmund Husserl. Husserl was one of the early, what are called in philosophy, phenomenologists, people who would study nature by looking at how it affects our experience rather than studying the nature out there. In other words, science studies nature as it exists outside of us. The phenomenologists study nature as it exists or as we experience it inside of us. Schutz brought this into the study of the social realm. And looking at how the consciousness of individuals vary depending on the role they're playing in the community. For example, imagine yourself as a stranger at Holden Village. And when you're here for quite a while, you start getting into a routine and you experience Holden Village in a certain way. But how does that look to an outsider or to someone who is not part of the community? Imagine, on another analogy, imagine taking someone to your church who maybe is not acquainted with Lutheranism. But one of the things that if you've ever gone to or gone much to a Lutheran church, you realize that probably strangers don't understand is all this paging around, you know, through hymnals and this and that, and trying to find where you are in the service and so on. If you take someone to your church who hasn't experienced Lutheranism before, to make them comfortable, you have to imagine how they're looking at what they're experiencing so that you can help them understand. Lots of us don't, or we don't have, do this very well at some times. And so we find that a person is experiencing something much differently than we ourselves are. And then it becomes difficult to communicate. Well, Schutz did studies of these, how people in different social roles view social reality. The Stranger was one study. The Homecomer, you know, maybe you've experienced this and you've been away from your home for a while, and you come back and you view it differently than you did. And you know you're viewing it differently than those people who are there. And you may then try to communicate your impressions and find that they're much different than those people who, like your mother or your father or your brother or sister, who are living there. He studied the musician, the fantasizer, the dreamer, the scientist. More recently, there's a sociologist who's also died named Irving Goffman, who carried on this tradition and embedded it in what he called frame analysis. And what he meant by this was that we experience our everyday reality within certain frames. And he uses this because the analogy to a picture is, and a wall. You know, if you go to a gallery and look at paintings, sometimes what the artist tries to do is show you where the painting stops and the wall begins by putting a frame around it. In other words, this piece of art is contained within a frame, and that's what you're supposed to concentrate on. Maybe you've had the experience of going to a gallery and you look at all of a sudden see something on the wall beside a painting that's more fascinating to you than what's in the painting.
It's a light switch.
Right. And that's another point, that some artists try to incorporate parts of the wall or parts of whatever the other medium is into the work itself. But somehow when we're as critics or when we're supposed to experience the art, we're supposed to see where it stops and where other parts of reality begin. Likewise, in our everyday consciousness, we attune ourselves to certain frames, like this is a frame right here where we're sitting around now. And there's things that are going on outside of this frame. And one of the problems of where we are, of koinonia in this room, is that there's a lot of other activities that go on. And if we're concentrating or if we're involved in one frame and we're disrupted, you know, like some children come running through or we hear sounds from the kitchen, something like that, we break out of the frame, and that becomes somewhat uncomfortable for us. So, but for us right now, if we're concentrating on what we're doing, what's happening around in this circle is real for us. The other things have, outside this circle, have elements of unreality, and simply because we're probably not attuned to them. That's something else that's going on someplace else. And for us, the part of everyday reality that appears to us to be real is going on right in here. Schutz called these things finite provinces of meaning. The everyday life world is a finite province of meaning. But I think we can just use the term reality so we don't have to deal with cumbersome terms. And then besides everyday reality, there's these secondary subworlds of reality that we enter occasionally. Dreams, fantasies, doing science. The theoretical physicist is often some totally different world. And to communicate to us what's going on in that other world, the scientist has to come back to the everyday world and use the language of everyday world, of the everyday world, to communicate to us. But to do science many times means to escape or to be outside of the what we call the everyday reality. These worlds are real. These other realities are real to us when we're in them. When we're brought out of them, we experience a shock sometimes, especially if we're totally engrossed in some other world or other world of reality. We may be absorbed in a painting, a book that we're reading, or whatever, and a bell rings or something happens and shocks us back into reality. I remember that happening to me, I think, for the first time when I was in the fourth grade. We had reading time in our schoolroom. And I remember, for the first time, having the experience of being totally engrossed in a book. and not wanting to leave that world.
Was it
Frank Grant? I think it was the biography of Jim Bridger, Frontier Scout. But, you know, not wanting to leave that that reality and coming back to everyday reality. And I hope you're starting to see the analogy now to spiritual experience, too. Schutz pointed out some of the differences between the various types of reality on the basis of, for example, tensions of consciousness. Sometimes we really have to concentrate. Like in the everyday world that we're acting upon and is acting upon us, we have to be awake. If you're not awake, you may get in an accident or something like that. You have to attune to the things around you. And what he called the everyday world would be that world which requires the highest level of tension. But then there's also the dream world and other worlds that maybe were almost totally passive and relaxed and they happen to us. And also then one of the other differences between these worlds of reality are forms of spontaneity. Whether we're acting within and upon the world or whether pretty much and whether we can transform that reality through work or whether it's just simply thought only without activity or action. And another difference between these worlds of reality is their form of sociality, whether we're required to communicate with other persons, to be understood by other persons, whether we have to worry about what's called intersubjective meanings, in other words, whether the words that I'm using mean the same thing to you as they mean to me, or whether the world happens to be rather solitary and where we're alone. Now, Schutz thought that the everyday reality was the most important and the paramount reality. It's the most conscious, where we're the most effective, physically active, and so on. But since that time, people have debated that notion because there's the possibility that, for example, to work ourselves into another reality may take a lot of hard work. It may take a lot of concentration and attentiveness, and some of us may use the everyday world in sort of a passive way, as just going through it in sort of a routine without much conscious thought. Now, what I wanted to, the analogy that I'm using is erotic reality. And it may have been something I'm hopefully that we've all experienced. And what happens when between these worlds or these different types of realities is that sometimes elements of one reality migrate into the other reality, and then we feel some kind of tension or some kind of uncomfortability, or we have to do something about that. Times Square, New York, is one of these places that's very difficult to go without thinking about sex. If you're on business, I don't know if you've ever been to Times Square, New York, but you have all of these pornographic movie houses. You have these huge billboards advertising movies that have erotic paintings on them, and you may say, "I don't want to be in that world." I want to be in my everyday world right now, but these cues keep pulling me out of that into this erotic reality. There may be, on the other hand, times that we want to be into erotic reality that everyday life pulls us out of and won't let us get into. Another example might be the movie critic or the person who, last year I took my class to a couple pornographic movies, but they weren't, the really disgusting type. The reason I took them was because both of the movies that I took them to were pornographic movies about pornography. They were movies within movies type of thing. And it was real easy to stand or sit back and discuss the movie as it's going on. and to make critical comments about it. And to, in other words, to not let ourselves go and get into the representations that were on the screen. In other words, not fall into erotic reality. And I think that when I was talking about the experience I had in Flagstaff, Arizona, going over all this pornographic material, obviously the person who goes into a pornographic bookstore and purchases or reviews that material is in a much different reality. We were in everyday reality, whereas supposedly the person who purchases and uses this material is in another reality, or maybe using it as a device to fall into erotic reality. Paul Ricoeur, who's another sociologist, has pointed out that Eros belongs to the pre-technical part of humankind, in the sense that if we get too technical with it, I think it was in the 50s when the subject of sexuality first began being discussed in public again, there was a lot of how-to manuals that came out, as we were talking about the other day, experts. We can't do these things without experts. They're not meaningful to us. They don't have legitimacy unless we read what an expert says about it. And the sex manuals are technical presentations. I remember when my father brought my sister was older than I was and brought a book home for her to read about human sexuality. And of course, I got my hands on it as quickly as I could and started paging through it. And it was really mostly a biological discussion, the estrus cycle and these sorts of things. And I thought, my own feelings have nothing to do with what's in that book. That's not how we experience sexuality. And that's what Ricoeur is getting to about Eros being part of the pre-technical part of human existence. And also that the erotic reality is pre-language. It's not logos. And language is another thing, or speaking or communicating, that breaks us out of erotic realm. So to sort of sum this up, I think the remarkable feature of humankind is that we can operate within different types of realities, and we can move from one to the other. And we can study for our own selves and introspect our own movement between these realms. And that we have this capacity is just simply remarkable to me. Augustine used this pull into erotic reality as his understanding of original sin, that we can't control ourselves, that our biology violates our intentions, that we find ourselves being pulled into erotic reality when we don't want to be. And for him, that was sort of a sign of what of this idea that we have to sin, or that we're forced to sin by our own natures. But I don't know whether he pointed this out, but there is also the other side of it too. And that's the times that we want to get into erotic reality that we can't, or that we aren't able to, that everyday reality pulls us out of. What if we lived in only one reality? What if, and I think that there are some social types we can point to that attempt to live in only one reality. Eunuchs maybe live only in everyday reality. Maybe this is something that nuns and monks who are cloistered or take vows attempt to achieve, is to only live in one or other realities besides the erotic reality. Those of us who experience spirituality and the spiritual realm, spiritual reality, may wish that at times that we could only live in that reality. And some people, I would think, would say that maybe that's part of our spiritual journey, is away from everyday reality to to eventually embrace only spiritual reality. And to do that, you see, this gets into what Susan Sontag is talking about with the story of O, is transcending our personality, transcending that part of our nature that needs to live in everyday life, and somehow going beyond it by denying ourselves and becoming truly humble, unable to be humiliated, transcending our personality, to become what might be called a pure religious object. Like the story of O, in the story of O, O tried to become a pure sexual object. No thoughts or feelings of her own. Complete abandonment of self. In the story of O, the preface talks about the problems of slaves that are freed from slavery. A lot of them don't want to be freed from slavery. That they go back and ask to live in the same kind of condition as before. Freedom isn't something that people take up automatically, just because it's handed to them. So, one of the points I'm trying to get to is that the spiritual, or what we refer to as the spirit and the flesh, can be understood as two separate realities, aside from the everyday reality that we live in. And so, as so often in the Pauline epistles, or in the writings of Paul, he talks about and opposes the spirit and the flesh. He doesn't talk a lot about this everyday reality that we find ourselves in that we have to deal with, just because we're biological humans and live in society and culture, which I think Paul did pretty well himself deal with. But if we can understand it as a descent, the flesh being a descent away from everyday reality, and the spiritual being an ascent also away from everyday reality, then I think what he's talking about might be a little clearer. When we make the shift from one reality to another, our system of relevances change. And I want to talk a little bit about what the system of relevances, in other words, what the system of relevances refers to is our ranking of things that are important to us in one reality versus another reality, and from one reality to another, those system or that ranking will change. You can obviously see this in terms of erotic reality. That's what's important in that realm is a different system or set of things than. They may be the same things, but they're defined differently to us. I might give you an example. To look at another person in a social role of everyday reality might be someone like teacher, friend, or whatever. In erotic reality, that person is transformed into being a sexual object. Sometimes we find ourselves doing this in this is sort of the pull of erotic reality. Sometimes we find ourselves doing this in everyday life, and we don't, you know, we say, wait a minute, what am I thinking about here? Now, I wanted to list some of these categories of relevances, because what I'd like you to do between now and the next time that we meet is to think of your system, your own personal system of relevances in the area of spiritual reality. And in other words, think about your own journey into spiritual reality and how the definition of things change. Some things become more important than others. And make a study of that journey for yourself. That yourself makes. The major factors that I want to talk a little bit about are temporal factors, having to do with time, spatial factors, social factors, and physical factors. First of all, time. The journey into spiritual reality may be, or obviously is, an interruption. It may be for you anyway. An interruption in the time of everyday life. It's like, to use an analogy, fun time, you know, recess at school. It's an interruption in the supposedly important events that are going along. Think about when the shift starts for you, and how long does it go? Some people, for example, for Sunday worship, begin getting ready on Saturday or Friday, and start working themselves up to it. There may be a difference, in erotic reality, to use that as an analogy. A lot of authors have pointed out a difference in time between men and women that's pretty basic, and that seems to be found in most cultures. Men have a tendency to isolate the sexual act itself as the goal and the meaning of this erotic reality, whereas women tend to extend the time so that it's not just the act itself, but the period after it, which is also part and meaning and very relevant to them. So how long does it go, you know, or what are the borders in terms of time? When are the best times? Like during the week, or during the year, during the day? Bedtime, early morning, Sunday, whatever. It might help you to think of the times that are the worst. Are there some times that are very difficult or impossible to think about in terms of spiritual reality? Work, like maybe during work. Eating, something else like that. And then space as another hallmark. The spatial expanse of everyday life may diminish during spiritual reality. Like in concentrated reading or concentrated work. How about a certain place? Like a beach, the woods, a mountaintop, a church, a room. A motel. There's certain, if we think about places as being cut off from everyday life, more so than other places, or maybe not. Places that are an ongoing everyday life. Yesterday, Carolyn talked about Fritz Norstad's idea about choosing a place at Holden to observe and to see its changes. It might be a key for you to think about what kinds of places are most meaningful for you in that sense. Candlelight. Moonlight. These might be parts of the physical aspects, though. And then social. Is this spiritual journey take place, or this transition to spiritual reality take place alone? Does it help to have others there? Or which others? Does it have anything to do with gender? Or age, or the social role, like priest, mother, father, and so on, of another person. And then the last factor, the physical. This includes things like voice, maybe, or silence, smell. Are there smells that key you in? The smell of incense. Just think of the setting, objects of one sort or another, sounds. Music of one sort or another. Can you think of anything I might have left out in these areas? Okay. Now, do you have any questions or comments about that? I'd like you to write this up. It doesn't have to be, you know, you can make it as long as you want to because it's sort of your own journey. And so maybe if you've never thought about it before, maybe it's something you have difficulty thinking about. There may not be much you can conjure up at all. But then there may be people who have made a study of this for themselves. Herself. We can have a lot more.
I'd like to ask a question for clarification. Now when you call your talk, the split between the flesh and the spirit, do you then assume that there is a split between spirituality and the spiritual and the erotic realm? Or do you find that there is that there is a kind of continuation, or that it's connected, and that it is rather a cultural split that has been inflicted on our consciousness?
Well, I think that's a good question. I've thought of that myself. I think there's one way of approaching that is to see how within a culture we label some realities as good or bad, and also the time in which they take place is good or bad. We may say, as I wanted to get into a little bit more this morning, from centuries past, it may have been that erotic reality was considered so dangerous that we had to avoid it at all, or any way possible that we would not even think about it, hopefully. The example that I've heard several people use concerning the time probably of the severest sexual repression in recent years during the Victorian and Edwardian periods, referring to the middle to the late 1800s, that the Victorians would put skirts around piano legs. Because the curves of the piano legs might make people think about sex. Now, of course, not all cultures do that, but all cultures do label and divide things into acceptable and unacceptable, good, bad, good, evil. And I think these realities, too, come to get those labels within a culture so that there's within any particular culture, there'll be that kind of a standard. And I think it goes to the root of human consciousness in that we do experience them as separations. Now, if you've read any of the mystics, religious mystics, you can see one of the things they're interested in is getting a spiritual reality into all to enter into consciousness, perpetual consciousness. Some of the mystics talk about developing a prayer that becomes synonymous with the rhythm of life itself, so that one is always more or less into a spiritual reality at all times. But see, to me that just reemphasizes the distinction that they also recognize that then there's this split out of that too, that they would like to avoid as much as possible. Now, as I say, it goes back basically, to, I think, to human consciousness in, or as its basis. And I think in the book, this book, Escape from Evil by Ernest Becker, he points out that something that I think is true, that it wasn't until just the last few decades that anthropologists finally started making sense out of the primitive psyche or the primitive mind. And what the breakthrough was the discovery that the primitive mind isn't really essentially different than the modern mind. That anthropologists up until recently kept going out and saying, what's going on in these, you know, if you look at the reports that anthropologists bring back of primitive cultures, you find all these rituals people are doing, all these strange practices, and that are so different than our modern civilization. And so, you know, the obvious step is to say, gee, how are they different? You know, what's going on in their mind? And the breakthrough was by people like Claude Levi-Strauss, and others who saw the same some of the same things going on, only in different form. And this system of taboos that primitive people have, whether they put a label on everything, good or bad, you know, this kind of thing, is a connection between that they've made between nature and the cosmos. One that we probably don't understand so well now because our science is so secular. But that system of taboo, and the good and the bad, was the primitive scientific system. That's how they made sense out of the world and ordered the world. That was their science. And that's how the world they used the world, or they used a system of good or bad to make sense out of things. And, you know, we think in our own, you know, our own practices, we think are much more rational, but we can point out examples where they're not. For example, if you see a kid, your child, drinking some milk, and they put the milk in their mouth, and they swish it around, and they put it back in the glass, or they chew their food and they take it out. You know, you watch a baby eat, they chew their food, they take it out, and they look at it, this ugly mess, you know, or they smear it on the wall, they put it back in their mouth. And to us, that's disgusting. But why should it be disgusting? You know, it was in our mouth, now it's out of our mouth, now it's in our mouth again. What's wrong with that? You know, it's not even unhygienic. But to us it seems to be disgusting, because one of the first things we learn is once something goes in there and it comes back out, don't put it back in again. That's the first teachings that we have. In other words, this good, bad, you know, this, it's good, then you put it in there and it comes back out, it's bad. You know, stay away from it. And it's you know, if you know about computer languages, the essence of the computer is the same system. It's this binary system, present, absence. It's the same science that the primitives use, that we still are using today. So in order to order our world, we put these signs on things, plus, minus, positive, negative. And that's how we go through our everyday reality. But also then these realities come to have these designations too. And I think we do experience them that way in our deeper levels of consciousness. Does that help at all? The change from one reality to another is going to be more or less abrupt. You know, think about it this way. If you go to the theater, and you have to develop a different set of consciousness or a different style of consciousness to enjoy a play. And usually the sign that is now time to get into this new realm of consciousness is that the curtain goes up, and then it ends when the curtain goes down. But from the time the curtain goes up to the curtain goes down, to really enjoy that play, we have to transform our level of consciousness.
I'm not read enough in this field really to be conscious. What proves that there is really a different style of consciousness? Now again, you know, I don't know Schutz or anything else, why isn't it the same kind of consciousness I have in trying to understand that? And she and I sit down and have. And there's no play, there's no other thing, but I'm entering into her world as she speaks, and she's entering into mine. Is that different for you? My question coming back is whether there really are differences in reality.
Well,
the premise seems to be that there are.
My premise is that there are, and the basis is our experience of these different realms.
And that's what I'm not connecting with, is not connecting with the experience. The labels of things being bad or good, that helps.
Can I use another example?
Sure.
This may be more meaningful, I don't know. But it has to do with the realm of worship. If we enter, like, just a normal worship service, what are these people doing? You know, they stand up, they sit down, they say these chants. What's going on?
The same thing they do at work.
Right. But
they stand up. They sit
we
down,
have the conscious ability to objectify ourselves from that situation and not to be part of it. See, and that's what I'm saying, is that we are remarkable as human beings because we can live and work in and understand these shifts in our reality.
See, I'm still questioning whether they are really shifts or not, but that they're just a whole variation of one reality. That work is not unlike worship at all or going for a play. That all three of those are one.
But the system of relevance has changed. What's important in one realm is not so important in another, or it takes on a different definition or meaning in another
realm.
And
I'm saying, does that make it a different reality? There's an assumption that that makes it a different reality. I don't have the experience or the evidence or whatever else it is that says that makes it a different reality. The fact that different things are important at different times doesn't logically say to me, oh, different reality. It just means different things are important at different times.
Could you substitute a word and say whose focus? Your focus changes. Or is that changing your meaning a whole lot?
Well, the focus changes, but the reason the focus changes, you see, is what I'm saying. The reason the focus changes is because it's a different reality. And now the reality has to do with these different focuses. Or foci, or whatever. And the fact that we understand them that way. To pursue a certain level or a certain kind of reality, we can do that to one degree or more. And each of us, I think, understands that too, that it's possible to get into one thing or another more so than another.
Your example of a theater and so on, I'm not sure I'm understanding what you're saying, but if I was, I think, to me, I would experience that as you were describing it. When I was out in Seattle, I had an opportunity to go to the movie Out of Africa by myself. There were many things that related, reasons and things for which I related to that very strongly. And when I came out of that, I had a great deal of trouble focusing back onto the everyday reality again. You know, just to think about now I'm driving and, you know, remembering I'm on the right side of the road here in the U.S. and so on. And when we talk about, what's the expression we use? When we become so engrossed in something and then we find it hard. just a minute ago.
Transition.
Just a phrase. Anyway, but that's what I was feeling. You know, I could hardly get back into the reality of what I was doing every day because I was so into that film. Now, I don't know. I took it that that's a little bit what you're saying, that I was moving from one reality to another.
What I was going from is experience. Now, if you don't have this experience, I can't say, well, you're wrong because you don't have this experience. But what I'm trying to say is that, as I think in the communication that we have with one another, that we recognize that we do make these transitions, and that the movement from one reality to another is something that sometimes we work on, or that we seek cues from, or we void cues that cue us into one or another, and then that we put labels on these realities, and we do that in terms of time, place, or just maybe their existence or non-existence.
I'm not sure how this relates to presuppositions of like health, healing, wholeness, but I can relate to what you're saying in that I experience reality at different levels, but I also feel fragmented when I do and feel whole to the degree I can sort of put it all together and assimilate everything, and I feel kind of like a Buddhist, it sort of rings up, trying to climb out of reality. If we were lights, as Jesus said in the world, he says, you know, shine on a hill, whereas a Buddhist would say, just kind of snuff it out and climb into your spiritual reality. And I feel like, you know, I want that. I feel healthy when that spiritual reality invades my real everyday reality, and when that erotic reality finds its niche in there too. I mean, not sure how it all fits, but I think that's sort of the goal of living, is to put it all together.